Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Well, hello and welcome to the Big Change Podcast, and in fact, the final of our series of 12 episodes looking at big change, how ordinary Christians can change their world. My name is Jonathan Wilson, and I'm your host. And today, in this final episode, I'm joined by Justina Ojom. Justina, it is lovely to have you. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor.
So I want to set this conversation up by first telling you why I've asked Justina to join us in this episode, and then I'm going to introduce her a bit. I'm going to start first, though, with reading from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, where the writer says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Indeed, by faith, our ancestors received approval." And if you read the rest of this passage, it's very interesting because the writer then lists out all these quote-unquote heroes of the biblical faith, people who, in some way or other, trusted God and followed him and pursued him, but pursued him, yes, in light of or with a vision of what was possible. And Justina, what you and I are here to talk about is the pursuit of big change. And yet, the consistent refrain throughout this particular chapter is none of them actually saw the fulfillment of that. I think what's very important about this passage is understanding what the writer means when he says that people are living by faith and faith in the unseen. And if you read that chapter and you realize what it is that they're pursuing, he's not talking about their faith in God per se, although that is definitely there. And it's, in fact, you could say that's the foundational piece. It's their faith in what will come about by pursuing God's call on them in this world. It's their faith that what is not seen now, because it hasn't happened yet. It's their faith that the big change that we so long to see happen will happen, but it's not visible now. I'm going to chase it. That's what this passage is actually about. And that's why I've invited you on, because you're relatively young, at least compared to me, but you do have experience. You've been in the workplace. We'll be talking about some of your experiences in a moment, but you have runway. And you are definitely somebody in pursuit of big change, and you've got years of runway ahead of you, more than I do, unless something miraculous happens and I live beyond 100. So I think it's going to be really helpful for the audience to hear the thoughts and reflections of somebody who's looking ahead at what is unseen and what it means to then start to live your life according to the unseen, the not yet materialized vision of big change. But just to introduce you to listeners with a bit more detail. So I know Justina both as a professional and as a fellow Christian. She's a very serious follower of Jesus and very passionate about our God who has rescued us, which has been one of the themes of this series. But professionally, Justina is a design and innovation consultant, primarily servicing the social sector, so not-for-profits, NGOs, organizations like World Vision, don't know what others might be helpful for people to know about that you've worked for.
International Rescue Committee, Institute of Security Studies, which is a South African research organization that focuses on violence prevention, World Food Program. Yeah, those are the big names.
that's great. So what Justina brings to her clients is her expertise to her ability to meaningfully and purposefully understand and involve people in designing the solutions that are meant to impact those people. And as I've listened to Justina over the months that I've known her, I've really appreciated the very careful way you're attentive to the individuals and the communities that outside NGOs are trying to bring some sort of change or transformation to, and you very respectful of the people that you work with. You know, in our culture, typically, we're very black and white in how we do things, and it's very simple to have an oppressor and a victim and to leave it there. And you've respectfully engaged people who fit both categories. And hopefully we'll hear more about that. Let's just return to this theme of big change and the way we've been unpacking it on the podcast, which is the big change through a biblical or a Christian lens is ultimately some large-scale systems change that has arisen or comes out of the work of reconciliation, where a reconciliation with God, where we get rescued out of our sin and our brokenness by Him, by His kindness and His initiative towards us, which we saw on the cross, but then also through the reorientation of our minds. And that's something that a lot of your work engages with, that changing how our mental maps, how we think about things, to the repair that needs to take place, just the pure, simple fact that damage has been done. And as Christians, we have a role in repairing that damage. And then the ultimate goal of all things being brought back into right order, well-ordered relationships rooted in love and service. And this is what big change is. So, Justina Ojom, the dancer, the actress, design thinker, what big change do you care about? What has God put on your heart? What are you wanting to be a part of in this world?
I think one thing that has stood out to me, and I've learned it as I've engaged in the international development sector, is the brokenness of that sector. And it was spoken about in one of your earlier episodes about the accountability mechanism not existing in that space because there is a donor who is not the end user, you could say, or the people who are actually impacted by the solutions funded by the donor. And it's really hard to break that decision-making power from the money. And one thing I would love to see as a change, you know, is that there's no such thing as international development, but just international exchange, that recognizing that every culture, people, place has something to offer in making the world a better place. So it separates a little bit from what is now very mainstream as localization or decolonization, to say we don't need your ideas anymore, the colonizer's ideas. You know, we're going to save ourselves and we're capable of that. I think it only furthers the separation or perpetuates the othering of each other. And I would love to see just more of an exchange of, you know, that you are gifted in one way, I'm gifted in another, and we can offer that to each other. And my understanding of the capital world and how the essence of it is with people's talents or resources or efficiencies, that they're actually offering what they have in exchange for something else that they need from somebody else who has something but need what they can offer. You know, so that's one area I would love to revolutionize, is when we're talking about helping each other out, there's not one group that is doing the helping and the other is just doing the receiving. And I think that's more reflective of what reality is that even though I'm doing this development work, I am 100% learning and being shaped by the people who I'm working with, and they offer something back to me. And a lot of my expertise is not from the academic world or from conducting big studies, but from their voices. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me a bit more. By the way, I love how you just expressed that, the idea of an international exchange as opposed to international development. There should be no such thing as international development. That's a great line. But you've been in situations where you see those disparities of power, or you've seen those unequal power dynamics in play, where there's an NGO with good intentions engaging a community in order to bring about some kind of social change. But that power imbalance is in play. And there's also assumptions and perceptions at play that, as I've listened to your stories, and I've seen this as well in the NGO sector, or in any context, where we have our idea about what people need. I'd love to hear a bit more of those stories and just help us understand what you've seen and what you've observed about these power dynamics and what you sought to do in your own style and approach to maybe to switch that up a bit.
Yeah. So one very strong example was when I was doing work in supporting faith leaders in Uganda on how to respond to gender-based violence, specifically intimate partner violence, most often from the man to the woman. And we had a very secular team, and I am the only Christian on the team, at least in the North American side. We do have Ugandans who are working with us too, who have more of the faith background or more religious, but yeah, the real decision makers are experts in gender who are quite secular. But we were working with faith leaders because they have influence over the Ugandan, over rural Ugandans specifically. And so in doing the research, we started with women because we have to be survivor-centered. And the assumption we went with was that these women need support in accessing safety when violence happens in their home, and that faith leaders need to help women get to safety and in some cases separate from her partner to keep her safe. And so the women were the first I talked to, and we were testing prototypes on, you know, what exactly will help women get to that safety in a way that will keep her safe. It can't be a tool that the man will see as threatening to his position. And I was testing, you know, different ideas. But the one resounding thing that I kept hearing from the woman were like, okay, great. I know where I go to be safe, but it would be better if you just talk to the men, help change their behavior, help them not beat me, you know? And so, of course, all of my intention is to listen to them, but it really goes against what a lot of the people working in the gender field wanted to care about, was like, we should be so survivor-centered that we only talk to survivors. And so I had a really great design lead who helped me push to speak to the men, you know? After all, this was going to be embedded into a couples counseling program. And so we fought and we were able to do that. And I got to sit with both men and women together as couples. And then I talked to the women, I talked to the men. And it was by talking to the men that I could dive deeper into what was behind the violence from their perspective. And I don't think that that has ever been asked of the men. And one of the things that, I mean, academics already know this, violence is justified in a lot of cases to be, you know, the response to disobedience or disrespect, infidelity, things that in general hurt the man. And both men and women were agreeing to that, to say, what else can he do? You know, a man needs his respect.
So the women would also acknowledge,
yes,
that this was a value, a priority.
Yeah, it was agreed by both, even though everybody says violence is wrong. So it was in a focus group that I was sitting with men who admitted that they have beaten their wives before. And I remember 5 out of 6 of them, when I offered the hypothetical situation that, oh, what if a woman cheats on you? And then they will say, oh, yeah, I can't help but beat her. One man was like, no, I would never. I thought that was an interesting anomaly. But, you know, I was thinking about all the past interviews and the and this thing about respect kept coming up, disrespect and a man's respect. And I, and having lived in the Ugandan culture, I've learned about how I have to dress respectfully, act respectfully. And so I was like, wait, there's something about respect that matters. And so I offered an alternative world to the men. And I said, what if there was a different world where your respect is not defined by how your wife treats you, but about how you treat her. And that's how you earn your respect. And that's where your respect really comes from. And then all of the men were like, oh, well, if that were true, then I have no reason to beat her. And so that was one of the pivotal moments that changed what our additional piece to the couples counseling curriculum. Originally, it was going to mostly be about safety, but we added a whole section on respect.
That's a great story. What stands out to me as you share is when violence is committed against someone, it's a violation of their dignity. And so as a result of that, we other the perpetrator. That's just, it's bad, it's wrong, and it stops there. And there's no further pushing into the life and experience of the perpetrator. And you went there. One of the things that we've talked about in this podcast series is how when you compel people to change, we had this conversation just the previous episode with Sammy, with the institution of slavery. And when you simply try to bring a stop to something through legislation or through some sort of forced behavior change, you're not actually introducing a qualitative change. And one of the results of that kind of behavior is it actually can lead to further alienation. And you can see how a program that has a good and actually necessary intention, which is to protect women, could, by ignoring the men, actually create further alienation between women and the very people that they need to be in relationship with in order to live their lives. I guess the question I have as I listen to that is, you're operating in a world or in an environment, I'm not talking about Uganda, I'm talking about the NGO and its objectives, where there is this very clear demarcation between perpetrator and victim, and you're looking at it through a different lens. I guess I'm interested in, how do you navigate that kind of tension? Because for the NGO, that frame that they're operating from within is deeply moral.
Yeah.
But in the Ugandans' world, they're operating also from within what they would regard as a moral frame. So just curious as to how you navigated that.
Yeah. You know, one thing that is really interesting is that in the world that I had stepped into, the victims were not the women. They were the men for being disrespected. We've talked about this before, about how in victimhood, we sometimes give ourselves the justifiable reason to react in a way that is harmful to the very person that we feel we were a victim of. And in that experience, or in that conversation I had with these men, I was almost placing responsibility back in their hands to say, you might have felt like you're the victim, but you're still responsible for your own actions. And sometimes that goes amiss in this world of activism, especially the victims. The socially trending victims right now have a huge voice, and oftentimes it's used in a harmful way, and then it's justified because of their victimhood. And there's almost a power play where people want to add to their victimhood to find reasons to be offended. But that's right, not answering your question.
What I'm thinking of as I ask that question is I've heard you talk about secular-based NGO, but you're working with faith-based leaders in Ghana. I think what's helpful maybe to clarify there is you're not saying that pejoratively about either one, but the frames of reference are operating from within. So the one is non-religious and probably doesn't place a priority on how religious thinking or beliefs or values might inform people's decisions. And yet the community you're working with is deeply religious. And so you navigated that tension, those different sets of priorities and assumptions, as well as the different priorities and assumptions around the victim-perpetrator structure. And I'm curious, like, how you did that, how you carried yourself through that.
One thing for sure is that I built my credibility off of the voices of the people I was talking to. So in the secular space of those who were actually leading the project, I appreciated actually that they had the full intention of listening or wanting to make sure it was human-centered. So completely driven by the voices and the perspectives of the communities we were working with. Yeah, there was still a sort of separation of what religion means. Because I'm a Christian, it helped me connect to faith leaders and the people who also look up to their faith leaders and are Christian. And sometimes it took effort to explain it back to this, to the leadership or the secular team, but still knowing that there's this understanding of what prayer means, that it's not just a behavioral change tactic, but that there's like real spiritual power in that. And, you know, even the method itself, the project is so successful, and you could say it was well led, and it used human-centered design and behavioral science and all of the amazing tools that God's equipped us with, but it was also faith-based. And I think that gets lost, unfortunately, but even though it gets lost, God's still working in it, you know?
Right.
And that's the beautiful thing about it. And where I've wanted to put in my Christian input, because I am from outside of the community, it actually doesn't have credibility, but I am so grateful that the communities we're working with are Christian and their input is allowed to influence the project.
How did within the secular NGO, how did the leadership structure, how receptive were they? What was the journey for them working with you as a kind of almost like a mediator or a bridge to the Ugandan community? How was that dynamic?
It was interesting because I started this project and then I met my now husband from the project, and it's a couples counseling project. So in a way, I had a chance to resonate with the stories that we had in our program, which in some ways I also experience the same things. And it was through my relationship with him and the team, I was building really deep relationships with the community. And they were like, oh, let's just send Justina back. She has a boyfriend there and, you know, she works well with the team. So let's keep sending her. And that deepened my understanding of, you know, people who live there. And I got affected by them. And that almost helped shape some of my analysis. You know, the fact that respect kept coming back, because that also showed up in our relationship and in my friendships and how they would instruct me to go about, you know, living in Uganda. And in a way, I was able to serve and have some credibility because I was the one who was assigned to go and interview and have deep conversations with the community. But there were moments where at the end of the day, my perspective doesn't matter.
As I've listened to you, a few things have stood out tying to the themes that we've been covering in the podcast series. One is, you know, when we talk about reconciliation and the repair that's required, one thing that's come up several times in this podcast series is the need for proximity, and that proximity brings about the insight that's needed. Nobody wants to be proximate to people that they've judged as bad, you know, or dangerous even. And you've put yourself in proximity to not just the women who are the victims of gender-based violence, but to the men who are in that system. I think your story just bears the fruit or demonstrates the value of proximity. And I can imagine some listeners listening to the story that you've told so far and still finding themselves struggling that you would have put yourself alongside these men and listened to them and taken seriously their priority for respect. You know, it's like, well, who are they to demand respect? You know, they should just suck it up, you know, and not be so needy or, you know, whatever. But right there, that's a reaction, if I'm right, if that is how people might hear it. That's a reaction that comes from a distance. Proximity allows you to serve. It allows you to participate in and be in a way that is constructive and leads towards change. The other thing is that when you do it that way, you're bringing about change in a sort, again, to use the R's that we've been working with reorientation of people's mindsets, like what you said about men reframing how they think about where their dignity comes from, but also repair, bringing about the healing. The Westerner might think that solution is that the woman is completely liberated from any situation where she has to worry about men, let alone men beating her. Whereas what you were chasing after and what they wanted actually was a repair of those marital relationships. So that because they wanted to be with their husbands. It's not transactional, what you described. It's very life-giving, very redemptive.
One thing I reflect on while operating in international development, which I believe is quite broken in a lot of ways, is that the only thing that I have control over is my own interactions with people. As much as I'm working on things that can and have scaled to a whole country, a lot of that, there's so many other factors at play that I have no control over. Like if there's continued funding, if somebody else makes a different decision, you know, once it's in the implementer's hand, things are going to change with the solution that I have played a part in designing. And it can be quite discouraging for a lot of people working in the industry to be like, everything I do gets shut down or doesn't continue and all is lost. But I feel empowered by the fact that at least there's one way where I'm contributing, is that in these situations where I'm so privileged to be able to meet people who I would never, ever otherwise would have a chance to talk to and have a relationship with. That's my moment of impact, if anything.
If you've been enjoying the conversation so far, please share with your friends so that more people can discover how their faith can shape a better world.
Oh yeah, I want to come back to what you're saying about the role of prayer and the role of faith. That's a thing that the NGO, or at least a secular NGO, would screen that out as irrelevant. In the past, you've said to talk to me about the fact that the churches and the Christian leaders, the pastors and so on, they actually have a key role to play.
Yeah, one of the big reflections when I'm doing the work, and I know my work is often very focused on more of the physical needs, education, healthcare, even violence is largely about making sure people are physically safe and cared for, is that it needs to be complemented with the actual transformative work of those who are bringing the gospel into their lives. So a very poignant story that I heard from somebody when I was really early on in my career. He does microfinance, and he was trying to support a sex worker to leave sex work. And, you know, through microfinance, she could go and start her own business and find a way to make a living that doesn't rely on sex work. And so he gave her that, some microloans, and she was successful in that way. She was able to, you know, make her own business and be financially independent. But when he went back to visit her, she was still back doing sex work, even though she had this financial independence. And he asked her why. And she said, well, because these are the men that love me. And so he met a physical need, but the other need that needed to be addressed was where she found her worthiness. You know, the love that she needed, that she was, you know, just thirsting, but not getting the living water.
Yeah.
And so I feel that's where, you know, those who are working on delivering the gospel and discipling and helping people live out their faith, and that's their calling. I need them so much. as I'm helping with the physical aspects of providing and supporting people where they lack, I think we need those people to, we need to partner together. So in the profession of human-centered design, design thinking, mostly human-centered design, let's call it that, there is this approach where our intention is to figure out and not put our assumptions on what people need, want, and value, and the culture. Where this principle that I think, you know, more of the NGO sector is aligning to is like, oh, we must not come with our own ideology.
Right.
Is that there's certain, at a certain point, they're like, okay, this is their culture. But in their culture, you know, young girls are being married off. Women are being beaten. And at what point do you say, it becomes this weird, this tension actually within somebody who says morality is relative, you'd say, because that is the trend. That is what many people who are practicing human-centered design or are trying to change up international development is to say, we must adapt to their culture, their customs, their morals, until you reach a point where your own morals are conflicting with their morals. And it becomes, who gets to have a say in who's right? And most of the time, it's the West who wins. They say, we want to respect other people's culture. We're not here to do colonialism anymore, you know? But wherever there's a conflict of morals, we have better morals. But then there's like, oh, but I know I'm not supposed to impose my morals on another culture. And I think the freedom of Christianity is that not any of us are the ones who get to have a say on who's right. That I can actually give the authority to God and to say, it's not what my culture says, nor am I only going to listen to what your culture says is right. But there's one who is the one who is really the true authority on what is right and wrong. And that's where I'll, you know, submit that authority to. And sometimes I wish I could change the word human-centered design to God-centered design. But I mean, human-centered design is also the approach. But I do think it cannot exist without a direction of what you think human flourishing is. And every culture has its own idea of what that is. But we are blessed to have been given that, you know, through God's word. And we have that to be our guide instead of trying to figure it out ourselves. And I'm so grateful that I don't have to be the one to make those decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. So I operate in the impact investing world. And of course, the word impact is being borrowed from the NGO sector. And the idea of impact is that you define these key social change outcomes that you're working towards, and then you're measuring them. And so impact measurement is really important so that we're stewarding our resources well towards social change. And the point of measurement is to be able to know, am I actually achieving what I set out to achieve? And if not, how do I pivot? How do I adjust? And I believe in all of that. I think that's actually really, those are really important steps to be taking, is the proper stewardship of our time and our energy and our efforts. And the point of metrics as ways of tracking whether my assumptions were correct, that if I followed this method, I would get to this outcome. A little bit like what you did with gender-based violence. You're realizing along the way, I have to make some pivots here. And then you start to see some change. You start to see demonstration of the outcomes that you had hoped for. The question becomes, whose outcomes are we chasing after? You know, and you've been saying that over the course of this podcast. And I think that's a conversation that in the space I move in, the impact investing space, whether it's amongst Christians or non-Christians, and most of the people that I interact with are not Christian, but there's a similar conversation going on with Christians, is not going down to the basics and saying, what assumptions do we actually have about what constitutes flourishing? And people will say, well, science tells us. Well, up to a point, science can tell you, for example, that if I have the following nutrition, I will have the following outcomes. But it's the person who decides whether or not those outcomes are actually what I would constitute flourishing. So, you know, to make it very, very simple, if we're talking about health, an outcome could be that you live long, very long perhaps, but not necessarily always that healthy. Are you struggling with one thing or another through the course of your life, but you live long? Or you could live very well, but for a short lifespan. That's a complete theoretical comment there, but or illustration, I should say. But the point being is that we're making those kinds of trade-offs all the time. Which priority do I place higher value on? And we're not being honest about that in the impact investing world. And they're actually competing frames of understanding around what constitutes impact. And I'm not bringing that up to say, therefore, we need to abandon the project of talking about impact and outcomes and so on. I think we need to get honest about the moral underpinnings, or the moral assumptions, I mean, that underpin or shape our priorities. And you see this in Africa especially, and I'm sure it's the case in other parts of the global south, where the trending priorities in impact investing are priorities that come from the Western world. And they're not bad things. One of them is gender. A lot of money goes towards gender inclusion, gender-focused investing. Another would be climate. Not something I'd argue with as if it was not important. It is important. But when you ask Africans where they want to deploy their capital, there's a whole nother set of things that they will bring up. And they would actually relegate. Even women fund managers in Africa, I've heard, would prioritize capital that is not gender allocated, because if they can just go into business per se and build up those businesses and build up economic capacity, women will benefit. Are they right? Are they wrong? It's not for me to say, but what I'm trying to describe is they have their reasons for thinking that way. And those come into conflict with the agendas that you get from the global north. And what I think you're talking about, and this series has also been touching on, is we are not trying to put those two things into competition, but into dialogue, and ultimately into partnership. That there would be a listening and a proximity, and then a mutuality that arises.
Yeah, I'm thinking about a very interesting example recently, working on a project that is about contraceptives. Mostly, you know, the ultimate aim of the collective of organizations working together is to address something about teenage pregnancies, but to make sure that those who want and need contraceptives, youth specifically, are able to access them and are able to make informed choices about contraceptives. And the main scope of this very, I think it's very, very funded project across multiple countries is around youth advocacy and, you know, campaigning to youth, making sure they're informed, giving them power to ask for contraceptives and accessing it. I helped lead a design workshop with people who had gone out to do some interviews and actually talk to some young girls who actually live in the Kalangala Islands in Uganda. So there's maybe 64 islands, very few health facilities. These are communities that follow the fish. So they're constantly moving. So access is a big challenge for that community. And I don't think that there's a lot of adapting done for exactly what it's like to have an island life. And in mapping out, you know, the journey of a young woman, she's interested in contraceptives. There's a lot of myths and misconceptions that she's hearing, where contraceptives are bad for you. They're going to make you infertile. You're going to have really bad side effects. You should try this natural remedy instead. And so we took the team to dive into where are these myths and misconceptions coming from. And they largely come from the mothers, actually maybe both parents and older siblings or friends who have had contraceptives before. And if you look deeper into some of the stories, these contraceptives were given way back in, I don't know, the 80s or 90s, when there was a lot of money being poured into HIV and AIDS response and just trying to get everybody on contraceptives. And some health workers were sent out with quotas where you have to deliver this many contraceptives. And these are like injections, IUDs, or implants, things like that. And to meet the quotas, the health workers had to hide some information about side effects or complications. And as a result, there are women who got contraceptives, but they might have experienced side effects. And these health workers were just sent out to the islands, but then they go back. And there was nobody to do the post-contraceptive care. And especially if someone wanted to remove their contraceptive because of the side effects, the health facilities, they don't exist or they're not equipped to be able to do that. And so with such poor quality of care, or let's say poorly incentivized kind of health care, you end up with a generation of people who have a lot of fear and bad experiences, very negative experiences with contraceptives. And of course, out of their own experience and care for the next generation of girls, they're going to say, no, like, these contraceptives are going to hurt you. There's really bad side effects. You know, try something else. And yet the organization was very focused on youth advocacy. But if research could be really more driven by the voices of the community, we should do more in understanding what happened with the people who did receive contraceptives. What do they need now? How can we help take care of them and clarify what they experienced? Is it connected to the contraceptive? Was it something else? And they are the ones who actually influence the next generation of young people. And these NGOs come in thinking, we're the ones to empower the youth and say they just need to circumvent their parents and they will access the things that they need. When actually there's a relationship between young people and their parents or their older siblings. And without addressing them as a whole, we're going to create more separation and we might not actually see the impact that we want to see.
Yeah. And again, that's demonstrating not only, you know, where you have a Western cultural set of values that prioritizes individual freedom and liberation from anybody telling you what to do, championing the rights of young people, you know, empowering them, but in a way that secondly has the effect of alienating the young people from their parents and actually undermining the fabric of the community. And I'm assuming, I mean, listening to your story, that's actually damaging upwards, if you want to put it that way, up towards the parents and downwards to the kids. Again, this is not to create an East-West or Global North, Global South kind of animosity. One of the points that I've wanted to make a few times in this podcast, and maybe this is a place I can do it, is when we have power, we use it, as opposed to being discerning about whether or not to use my power in this situation. Typically, we use power the way we use money. I don't know many people who, if they used to receiving, I'm just making these numbers up, but if they're used to receiving a salary in the US of, say, $10,000 a month, or maybe they're just starting out, let's make it low for the American context. Let's say they're receiving a salary of like $3,000 a month, and then they get some promotions and now they're making 10. They were surviving on 3. They will not continue to spend a budget of 3. They'll open their budget up to create additional spend. We do the same with power. If we have it, we use it. We're not discriminating. We don't steward it. We don't budget it. And I think this is where, whenever we are in a situation where we have power, if you're from the Global North and you're working with a Global South partner and you have money, that is a type of power that is very tangible and real. And we tend to just unwittingly use it. It can make stuff happen. So we do, as opposed to stewarding and holding back and placing the primacy on a relationship that is mutual. And I think that's what you and I are both calling for, is a mutuality. And that mutuality is also going to require us to be very self-controlled with our resources and with what we can bring to bear in a situation. As you look forward into your career and your pathway ahead of you, you have tools. They're good tools. You've learned, you know, human-centered design. I would say in the business world, where human-centered design is coming in and has been for a few years now, and is extremely effective. It actually has the potential to get on the, in the business side, businesses to pay more true attention to their customer in a way that businesses always say they need to be customer-centric, but human-centered design allows them to do that. So you've got that toolkit. You've also got this passion, you know, to see big change. You've also seen your own limitations. You've seen the limitations of others. I'm curious as to, what do you think about going forward about how to leverage who you are, how to bring our to this task of big change?
Yeah, I think the very first thing is to die to myself and to recognize, or to give God the hold on my life to direct me where he sees fit in his mission, in bringing the kingdom here and advancing his kingdom here. I think that's what I've admired about many people here on the podcast, who don't give glory to themselves, but to be like, God is just using me and I want him to use me. And sometimes I have to remind myself of that in a prayer when I notice, you know, why am I not getting credit for this? Or why am I not in a more powerful position? To be like, okay, no, it's not about me. Like, God placed me in a position or in a relationship where you can use me. That's the first one. I think I've been on this journey of understanding that all of us are working, that there's many facets to big change. It's interesting. I graduated from business school. And then I found myself in the social sector, thinking that that was the only place where I could have impact. But I've learned throughout the years, and just hearing the different stories that people have, is that we are all in partnership. Whatever occupation or industry that we're in, we play a part and we lean on each other. And it has expanded my thinking to be like, okay, I can do social impact from different angles, whether it's working with government or working in the private sector, you know, within the church. I'm much more curious and open-minded to God placing me in opportunities that are not restricted to the NGO sector now.
I want to come back to what you said. That's the first thing about dying to self. And before we started recording, you talked about how Abraham was called. And he was called with nothing more than a direction as to where he was to go and to take everything and to go there. And so the destination is unseen. How does that dying to self and knowing that you're just playing a part, this is God's work, how does that not degenerate into passivity?
Yeah, there's a lot of discomfort, I would say. And that discomfort, it's tempting to be passive. I think that there's a combination of the fact that you're bringing up Hebrews 11 and that the sermon I heard this week was about Abraham being called out with God saying, but I'll show you where you're going to end up. But he doesn't say where we're going to end up. I'm living in that discomfort, especially because I'm like, I have this NGO sector experience and I also want to do acting, but I also want to do dancing and I know I can contribute to the world in some way and maybe different industries. But this was like 2 weeks ago. I was in my life group and we were just a group of girls praying for each other. And one of the ladies in my group, she was like, I'm feeling God speaking to me and telling you to keep showing up. And I was like, oh, I think that gave me the assurance or the validation to continue listening for opportunities and to keep showing up in the different spaces that I find myself in. That is what I'm doing. And it's very uncomfortable. And I feel like I don't know what direction God is taking me, but I'm going to keep showing up.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to that passage that I referred to at the beginning of the episode from Hebrews chapter 11. I just read from the introduction where he talks about this life of faith. And I think very often we see faith as simply an attitude. It's our trust. But it's a faith to then act. That is how faith shows up in action. And that's what's so interesting is if you actually read the rest of that passage, it's just full of verbs. And I'm going to go through them and list them. By faith, a particular individual obeyed and went. That was Abraham. By faith, someone lived as a foreigner. By faith, someone received. By faith, someone blessed. By faith, someone hid an endangered child. By faith, someone refused privilege. By faith, someone left their home and their privilege. By faith, someone kept God's laws. By faith, someone took, or the people of Israel took what appeared to be an impossible escape route. By faith, walls fell. By faith, Rahab escaped condemnation. Like it's just action word after action word, people acting in faith in the moment. And this is the thing, we sometimes talk, in those of us who are in this sort of activist world, we talk about writing history. It's not our job to write history. It's our job to show up as actors in history. And it's God who's writing the history. That's one piece. If we had the ability to write history, we would be monsters. We'd have way too much power. And it's for God to catch up what we're doing into his redeeming and transformative work. And the other thing that is key throughout this whole passage of Hebrews chapter 11 is how much suffering is involved in that journey. And you've alluded to that along the way, what you have to give up, you have to relinquish to make, and not just the spiritual, you said about dying to self, but the sacrifice of being sitting alongside the person you would rather not be sitting alongside, including the perpetrator of violence. So there's a suffering. But then the piece that I think is also really key is the last words of this chapter, chapter 11, verse 39, it says, yet all these people that he's just listed who acted in faith, though they were commended for their faith, they did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better, so that they would not, apart from us, be made complete. In other words, the work of all these different actors in history, none of them sees its completion, because it's not complete until everybody has played their part in it. And that's the part that I think is just amazing. And it reminds me of the missionary from the early part of the 1900s, Roland Allen wrote a book in which he said, the missionary endeavor is not one in which the sharing of the Christian faith is so that others can join us, but because we are not complete until they join us. It's the same idea in play. And then it's then that the writer goes on to say, therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. So Jesus, who pioneers our faith and completes our faith, he also took this journey, and he did it from a place of joy, joy of what was set before him, if he went through this sacrificial journey of suffering. There was a joy on the other side. That's the journey that you and I have been called to. That's the journey of big change, and it will cost us. It might even cost us our lives. In some way, it always costs us our lives, because we have to give up, we have to relinquish in order to be people who serve well. And yet, there's a joy at the other end of it. And it's a joy that won't be made or see its completion until everybody's played their part. Every person listening to this podcast has a part to play in bringing about the things of God, but not because of sheer genius or because they can bring tremendous corporate or secular power or government power to bear, even though some listeners have that power, but because if they relinquish themselves and participate in a larger task than they have wisdom to understand, they can be part of this.
No, I love that. it steps away from such a common mission of helping people be empowered, find their power, to then say, let go of your power, because there's a greater power that can work through your weaknesses or can work through what society says is a weak position or a weak role that you play. And it's so nice that we have that.
Yeah, you know, it's a privilege and it's a blessing. And I would hope that, especially for, well, for our Christian brothers and sisters listening, but also for people who are not Christians listening and who maybe worry that Christians can get self-righteous in our pursuit of these moral and sort of transformation-oriented causes. And we've touched on this in the series, but the reason we can be a part of it is not because we possess the better standards, you know, the superior practices, but because God in grace has called us, has forgiven us our sin, and has opened up a way for us to participate in his work. It requires humility to do that, which is something that probably all of us spend a lifetime learning, but it's a gift to be on this journey of big change.
I was on a panel recently with students, business school students of the school I was an alumni, and these are students who are interested in social impact. But one of the questions somebody had that I didn't get a chance to answer was about how she wanted to. She was like, I can't seem to find a job in social impact. I'm really struggling. How do I get there? You know, that's very career oriented. And one of the things that maybe to other people who are entering their careers and wanting to make impact is that you can make impact starting with where you are. That's one of the biggest realizations I've learned. And it keeps people who are actually in the social impact space humble to be like, yeah, I'm doing my part, but that should not give me more pride over somebody else who is an accountant or somebody else who is a dancer, you know, more righteousness because you are working directly on social issues. And you kind of bring this in the last episode about how, in a way, we are also part of the system. We contribute to it, whether positively or negatively. And in whatever roles that we play, in work or in our homes or in the communities, that we're always impacting socially. And we don't have to have a very directly social impact job to do something. To do something that will advance God's kingdom and actually make impact that contributes to human flourishing.
Yeah. It's about how we steward that situation that we're in, knowing that it can be caught up in amazing ways. And I think as we wrap this series, there's obviously many, many things that we've talked about over the course of this series, but I'm hoping that the conversation today encourages people that there's a role for the ordinary Christian, whether they're a dancer or an actress or whether they're in social activism itself, directly, as you said just now, but to take their place in the work of big change and to trust that God will catch up that work into something that really does make a difference. But it might take two or three or four generations. And if anybody is listening to this podcast episode for the first time, go back and listen to all the other ones, because you'll hear discussions with various guests describing detailed aspects of the journey of big change and all its different dimensions. But this has been quite the ride. And I thank you to listeners who've been tracking with us. And Justina, thank you so much for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I love your spirit and your insight. And I look forward to seeing what God is going to do with you in the coming years.
Me too.
So at the end of this series, this is your host, Jonathan Wilson, saying goodbye.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.